after the breeding season, it's possible they help the birds further stand out to potential mates. And if you were concerned about any puffins being blinded by powerful UV lights for this research, don't worry. Researchers developed special, adorable puffin sunglasses to block the light from the bird's eyes. With bills so bright, they gotta wear shades. For Bird Note, I'm Mark Bramhill.
Today on Wings, Cynthia Enlow on how feminist activists are strengthening international solidarity through local organizing and actions.
It takes a lot of energy to be a feminist, but it also is very energizing to be a feminist.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Cynthia Enlow, a feminist writer, lecturer, and researcher, has written 14 books on national and international women's issues and has lectured around the world. She has received many awards for her work, along with honorary doctorates from the University of London, Connecticut College, and the University of Lund in Sweden. This is Jana Juniper G. with Cynthia Enlow, speaking on her work and the many ways to build on and continue nurturing a transnational feminist movement.
I'm a university professor at Clark University here in Massachusetts, and my writing and teaching is particularly about transnational feminism, about women in globalized factories, and women's experiences of militarism. Those are the three general areas that I try to keep track of and scribble about. The newest book is called Seriously, with an exclamation mark, and the subtitle is Investigating Crashes, as in banking crashes, Investigating Crashes and Crises as If Women Mattered. And it just came out this past year. When you learn things, you just want to share it. So yeah. Writing books is just a way of sharing things that you learn and you want other people to know.
How would you define feminism?
Of course, there are many ways to define feminism, but I think one of the hallmarks of trying to be a feminist is taking women seriously. That is, to actually see women's experiences and women's ideas as worth paying close attention to. And that doesn't mean that you think all women or girls are heroes, or all women or girls are necessarily oppressed, or all women or girls are angels. It means that to be a feminist, for me, means paying close attention to women and girls will make you smarter about the world, about injustices in the world, but also about how those injustices can be resisted. So that's one of the hallmarks for me of being a feminist, is to really take seriously women's lives without imagining that all women are the same, certainly, or that all women have the same lack of privilege or the same kind of opportunities, but to take them seriously as a way of making sense of how the world works. The other thing about being a feminist, I think, is being interested in and intolerant of differences in power, unequal power, and unequal rights. To be a feminist does mean then that you are political in the broadest, deepest sense of being political, but you're political for the sake of understanding injustice and trying to achieve justice. And justice is something that's very, very difficult to understand. And so to be a feminist means you keep thinking about it, and you think about the ways in which you yourself are complicit, perhaps, in some kinds of injustice. And nobody's born a feminist. You have to learn how to be one. Mm-hmm. And you never are fully one. You're always every day trying to be a feminist. You have to constantly remind yourself you have to be curious about things you thought you didn't have to be curious about.
You are listening to Wings. And here's more from Cynthia Enloe.
One of the warnings, I think, that many feminists around the world are giving us these days is it's not only don't lump all quote-unquote Western women together, since Western women differ by their position in the racial hierarchies that are created unfairly, in the class economic hierarchies, but also we shouldn't lump together all women from even Indonesia or from Mexico or from Japan. Women are really diverse within countries as well, and globalization will have an impact on their lives that's really diverse. It means we have to be much more subtle and much more curious and much more energetic when we now think of which women in which countries at which moment are being disadvantaged because their farm products don't sell anymore or because they are working in unsafe factories, and which women are gaining new opportunities and not necessarily conscious of what those new globalized job opportunities are doing to women that they live just across the town from. The women in the countries where international capital and international export corporations have made the biggest interventions, they are the ones who really are teaching us how to be smart. So Chinese feminists, Hong Kong feminists, Indonesian feminists, Filipino feminists, Mexican, Nicaraguan, Colombian feminists, they're the ones really who can teach us how to pay attention both to the gender politics of their own local elites and the gender politics of foreign government elites and corporate decision makers. You have to watch all of them and their interactions with each other, especially when they go out drinking together, which they do. A lot of business is carried on in all-male drinking clubs.
When we look at international efforts to include more women in governments and decision-making bodies like banks and corporate offices, do you see other ways besides quotas and political party lists and constitutional reform that will continue to strengthen the indigenous women's places in these systems of power that have been primarily male-dominated up to now and even now?
Well, I think, first of all, the quotas and the lists, those really are important, and they're not very widely used. So the EU, for instance, just voted down, the EU Commission, European Union Commission in Brussels, just voted down a very strong proposal to use the Norwegian corporate board quota system for women. Just voted it down as an EU standard. So we shouldn't imagine that corporate board gender quotas or party nomination list gender quotas are widely in use. They are being used more than they were, say, 30 years ago, that's for sure. But we shouldn't imagine, oh, that's old hat. People are already using that. It works or it doesn't work or it barely works. Because, in fact, we scarcely know if it works. But you're right in thinking we've got to really have a really diverse, multi-tool toolbox to try and think about how to lessen the masculinization, particularly amongst privileged men. And in society, in different societies, who is a privileged man is going to differ. Because, you know, Sri Lanka is ethnically diverse, and Indonesia is ethnically diverse, and Mexico is ethnically diverse. So we shouldn't imagine it's just white and people of color. That's not how it works in a lot of societies. It's really by ethnicity and region. But we do have to figure out all the tools that we need in the feminist toolbox to try and pry open the doors of these exclusive decision-making bodies. And a lot of that work is being done by women's caucuses within, for instance, political parties. And women's caucuses have really had quite a powerful effect where those women have really been able to operate inside the parties. One of the things that I've learned recently, because I've been looking back a while ago, I spent a lot of time looking at women in the banana industry, and now I've come back to it and looked again. And one of the things I've noticed is that Honduran women, women in Honduras, who were working in the plantation packing houses of the big banana companies. This is Chiquita, Del Monte, and Dole. Those are the three big worldwide banana companies. And those women who were washing bananas, which meant that they were usually in pools of pesticide-ridden water, very dangerous for your health. But that's what women were hired on banana plantations. They were the washers of the bananas before they were sent down to the docks and put on the big refrigerated ships so that we could have them at our breakfast table. And those women who are way down the, way down the ladder of banana corporation power, they started organizing in the 1990s, first of all, to get their voices heard in the mainly, or almost all, male-led banana worker unions, while they challenged the big banana companies, Dole, Chiquita, Del Monte. They themselves were sexist in the sense that they assumed that only men really could run the banana workers' unions. And in the last 15, 20 years, these Honduran women have really trained themselves. They've had workshops. They practiced public speaking. They learned about the way the whole system of wages worked in their companies, and they have really made inroads into the unions and now hold more union leadership positions. And that in turn means that the big banana corporations have had to take women's concerns about family life, about women's health, much more seriously than they ever did before. It's not a total success story, but it is really a remarkable achievement for these women, starting with the Honduran women. Now they've trained women in Costa Rica and women in Colombia and women in the Philippines, all of whom have a lot more influence in the banana worker unions than they ever did before. And that, in turn, has meant that issues, for instance, such as sexual harassment, which nobody had taken seriously on banana plantations, neither the men who ran the workers' unions nor the men in the front office had ever taken sexual harassment seriously. Now one of the women leaders of the International Banana Workers Union has gotten Chiquita banana executives to sit down at a bargaining table and take seriously sexual harassment of women on the plantation workplaces. And that's a huge breakthrough. And it came from organizing, talking about what should be in the toolkit. The toolkit has to include lots of different kinds of organizing. And what feminists have taught us from the garment industry and from international domestic workers networks, what they've all taught us is that the kind of organizing that is most effective for women's lives, that allows women really to take part and to gain new skills in worker organizing, has to be really different than the kind of organizing that all male unions have used. For instance, one of the first lessons that they taught us all and tried to teach their male allies in the workers' organizations is you can't hold all your meetings after work if that means nighttime meetings, because women are expected to go right from their workplaces home and get their partners, their male partners, dinner on the table and take care of the kids. And if you have only nighttime meetings, it's almost a guarantee that you'll have only male workers at the meetings. The other thing they all have taught us is, what is a worker's issue? For a lot of women, a worker's issue includes sexual harassment on the job, not just wages. It also includes questions of which kinds of skills are women allowed to gain so that they can get better wages and promotions. And those sorts of issues were traditionally not taken up by male union organizers who allegedly were representing their interests. So the issues you have to take up for the sake of organizing, but also the ways in which you organize. Do you have childcare at your meetings? Do you take up domestic violence as an issue for women workers? Meaning, if they're out at night, will their male partners accuse them of having sexual liaisons. Women in Mexico City garment workers' factories said you have to take up domestic violence or you'll never get any women to come to a meeting. So there are lots of things we need to have in this feminist political toolbox that you learn by listening to women who try to organize and what kind of effective organizing is there and what kind of failures do women have when they try to organize. You learn from failures. We all do. And sometimes it's very painful to look at your failures. And sometimes looking at failures turns out to be just trying to assign blame rather than seeing it as a skill-building exercise.
Or a learning experience, for sure.
Yeah, and it's hard. It's tough.
It's all about what is and has happened and how people, women especially, are stepping up to the plate and doing what they can where they are.
Absolutely. And it means that what is considered political can look very minor when it starts. That is, women having workshops on a weekend in Honduras to learn how to speak at a public union meeting. That can look not as if it's about to shake up the world, but it has shaken up the world of the international politics of bananas. But it's taken 15 years.
I have to acknowledge the importance of those building blocks. I think that's what we're talking about, building blocks that increases the skills and knowledge of those involved, and then they run with it.
And which kinds of skills are women presumed not to need? And how do you break through that stereotype? Oh, that women don't have any business of speaking at a public meeting. Women who speak out don't look like proper women. They don't look respectable. And so you have to break through the stereotype, not only held by men, but oftentimes held by other women. She must not be a very good wife. Look at her speaking out in public when her husband is there. She'll embarrass him. It's one woman talking about another woman.
You're talking internal and external oppression.
I mean, patriarchy, you know, the systematic privileging of certain kinds of masculinities, patriarchy wouldn't exist for another 24 hours if a lot of women didn't find something in it that was rewarding. Wanting to be seen as a respectable woman, wanting to be seen as, always in quotes, beautiful, wanting to be seen as a good wife, wanting to be seen as a sacrificing mother. Those are rewards for a lot of women. And it's really hard to take the daring step of giving up those rewards. Even though patriarchy and patriarchal inequalities and inequities can be tracked back for generations, they don't stay the same. And the workings of the media, the workings of consumerist desires, the efforts to create genuine transnational networks, that's all new. So, yes, it's been going on for a long time. But it also keeps changing. You have to keep your eyes wide open.
You are listening to Wings and Cynthia Enloe talking about violence against women and how feminist activists from around the world are responding.
Well, I think one of the things that First Nation women have been doing in Canada is making visible these years-long patterns of government officials, police officials, court officials, not taking seriously the disappearance of First Nation girls and women. And so that organizing, that insisting that this is an issue, which means you have to show it's a pattern. That's one of the ways that you make something into an issue. You show that it's not just random, that it is a pattern. And once you can show people and embarrass authorities by showing that there's a pattern of neglect, you're much more likely to get a wider pressuring of public officials to take seriously something that they had rather not taken seriously. This is what a handful of three or four Bangladeshi feminists did in the 1980s and 90s when they went hospital to hospital to try and see if there was a pattern of men who were saw themselves as spurned as suitors throwing acid into the face of the young women that they were pursuing. And not until these Bangladeshi feminists, the small group of them, said, look, it doesn't just happen in this village, and then it happens a year later in another village, and then it happens 2 weeks later in this neighborhood of the city. There's a pattern here, and that's why we even now talk about acid-throwing violence. The fact that we here in Vancouver and Boston even use that phrase is because a small group of Bangladeshi feminists thought, you know what, this acid throwing is not just this disturbed young man getting acid and throwing it at the woman who won't be his wife. This is a pattern of violence against women, and it's a pattern of government and health officials not taking it seriously as a form of violence against women. And I think the same thing is true in Mexico. The reason that so many of us now, belatedly, are alarmed at the scores of women, most of them working women, that is women working in paid jobs, the reason that we now know about the large numbers of women who have been abducted and murdered in and around Juarez is because Mexican feminists in and around Juarez began to note the pattern and made the pattern visible and made the local and national Mexican police authorities' neglect of these crimes visible. And in Nigeria, where the Boko Haram, this very extremist group, militiamen, the reason most of us know about this now is because a group of Nigerian women, many of them mothers and aunts and sisters of the schoolgirls that were abducted when they were sleeping in a dormitory waiting to take their exams the next day. Most of us know about this because Nigerian women printed up T-shirts, printed up banners, and went into the main cities of Nigeria where local and national and international press would be. And with their T-shirts and their banners, they created the slogan, hashtag, bring our girls back. And so while now hashtag bring our girls back is now been co-opted and used in many other countries, that is, who are alarmed at this kidnapping, it was local Nigerian women who crafted that slogan, made up the T-shirts, made the banners, figure out where they could stand, write them in English so that the international media would pick them up. And that's the reason we know about this. Otherwise, we wouldn't know about this. Well, this is because of the activism and the strategizing of Nigerian women.
You are listening to Wings and Cynthia Enloe sharing ideas on how feminists are taking action in their home communities.
Local organizing, tracking patterns, making visible those patterns, and showing who has neglected and paying attention to those patterns of abuses of women, those are the people that we're all indebted to.
So I'm hearing that it really is important that local women start organizing among themselves around whatever issue is of importance to them at this time.
Absolutely. And the rest of us need to not just adopt hashtag bring back our girls, but need to think, oh, what else could those Nigerian activist women tell us? Rather than just thinking, send in the American or the African Union troops. If we are made aware of patterns of violence against women, for instance, on the border with Mexico, we need to think, oh, so let's not just be horrified. Let's figure out what else could those Mexican feminists tell us? What else is it that we need to learn from them? And I think very often, and all of us are guilty of this, we just get horrified and then we adopt our own analysis, which may not be entirely wrong, but not right enough, not correct enough. And we don't sort of hold on to our indebtedness to the local women activists who really are the ones who we need to listen to be made smarter. In other words, we're guilty of globalization ourselves. We take an issue oftentimes, and we then think we know all the nuances of it because it kind of fits with some things we've already been thinking about or we've been horrified in other settings. And then we stop listening to the Nigerian activist women, or we stop listening to the Mexican activist women, or we stop listening to the First Nation activist women.
It's all about building bridges between women in all parts of the world.
have to be bridges that run two ways. And for a lot of us, the bridges should run bridges of communication and bridges of understanding. They're bridges that we should listen to the women on the other side of the bridge before we start telling them what they should do. And that's not easy to do because the media, the international media, the most globalized of media, they'll show a photograph of the women standing in Lagos with their banners and their T-shirts with hashtag bring our girls back. But they won't, the international media won't then interview any of those women. They just treat them as if they're a photo op, not as if they are thinkers and strategists and policy advisors. So for all of us, it means that we've got to be much more energetic in finding what sources are available. So there is a journal, one of many journals, called Feminist Africa. Well, the writers and the editors of Feminist Africa might give us a much better sense of what Nigerian activist women have been doing for years that we've just never paid attention to until this mass kidnapping all of a sudden got us thinking about Nigerian girls and Nigerian women. But most of us haven't paid any attention to all the years of activism and thinking and strategizing that Nigerian women are doing. So for the first time, we're interested in Nigerian girls. We get horrified, but we don't think, gosh, is there any way I can listen to, eavesdrop on, overhear, learn from Nigerian women? And that's what we need to do. That's how you build a genuinely transnational feminist movement. But it means admitting that you don't know much and not being satisfied with mainstream notions of who's an expert.
You are listening to Wings and Cynthia Enloe on building bridges of solidarity and unity within the diversity of women that make up our world today.
We shouldn't imagine that Nigerian feminists don't have to deal with ethnic divisions. They're intense in Nigeria, ethnic divisions are. Religious differences in Nigeria are intense and highly politicized. Class differences, rural-urban differences amongst women in Nigeria are pronounced. So we shouldn't imagine we listen to Nigerian women as if any Nigerian woman can speak for all Nigerian women. But we can listen to those activist feminists in Nigeria and listen to them about how they try to overcome those differences, how they try to build solidarity across rural and urban women, which is one of the hardest things to do. And that's how we can learn, but not lumping women together in a country and think there is such a thing as the Chinese woman. There's no such thing as the Chinese woman or the Nigerian woman any more than all your listeners would ever talk about the Canadian woman.
Well, that's how mainstream media like to portray us.
Yeah, because I think that one of the distinguishing characteristics of a lot of mainstream media is that they deal in gross categories. And to be a feminist means to be really energetic and to be a lot more curious than most of us think we have the time to be on any busy day. So we do talk about Nigerian women. We do talk about First Nations women as if they're all the, you know, can be talked about without any differences. But, of course, that's what makes trying to be a feminist in one's life so exciting. It takes a lot of energy to be a feminist, but it also is very energizing to be a feminist. I'd have a lot more energy than I did before I became a feminist.
You have been listening to Wings, the Women's International News Gathering Service. And thanks to Cynthia Enloe, a feminist writer, lecturer, and researcher from the East Coast of North America. And this is Jana Juniper G from the Coast Salish Territories of Western Canada, your host for today. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded in 2014. Its advice is still good today. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose salons can be found on the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's all one word, maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings Sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU Burnaby.
Music and talk radio.